What's up, fellow travelers? Welcome to Traversing the Stars. Please welcome my special guest today, author, screenwriter, director, Caroline Thompson. Caroline, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. It's great to have you here. So tell everybody at home a little bit about you.
Oh, gosh. Oh, that's a general question. Well, there's Edward Scissorhands.
Love it.
There's Black Beauty. Come here, Tucci. There's my dog somewhere. Come here, Tucci. Tucci, say hi.
Come here, puppy. Hey, puppy.
This is my office. I mostly don't write these days. I mostly oil paint.
Cool. Okay.
I like to oil paint dead people and things, animals.
That's awesome. So what got you into oil painting? I mean, I honestly, that is the kind of talent like I can't even relate to. I can't draw to save my life. So like anytime somebody has any kind of talent with like drawing or painting or anything like that, it just blows me away.
Well, you'd be surprised. I had the same feeling you have.
Uh-huh.
But it would have been a lifelong dream to paint. And so I found a teacher and turns out I'm pretty good at it, actually.
That's awesome.
I've been doing it for a few years now. And I love it. And it's very meditative. It's very similar to writing in that you just mm-hmm. get lost in what you're doing. But it's not for hire. So that's a nice thing.
Yeah.
I live near the beach in California, which is sad.
Well, I was gonna say I don't live anywhere near a beach, so a little bit jealous.
It's very nice.
Cool. Well, so you got your start in the industry collaborating with Penelope Spheeris, who obviously as a metalhead, I love Penelope. Love her work on obviously Wayne's World, Decline of Western Civilization. So how was that getting started with her?
Well, so I wrote a novel, mm-hmm. And I was living in LA. Mm-hmm. I didn't move to LA to be in the movie business. I moved to LA to get as far away from the East Coast where I'm from as I possibly could.
I get that. I'm on the East Coast.
And stay on the continent. So that's how I wound up in LA. But my lifelong dream had been to write and publish a novel, which mm-hmm. I did. But I, by that time, had become fascinated by the movie business. So there were three people I wanted to direct that novel. One was David Lynch, because mm-hmm. it has a connection to Eraserhead, my book. Mm-hmm. The other was Brian De Palma, because Carrie is my favorite movie of all time.
Love it.
And the third was Penelope Spheeris, because I thought The Decline of Western Civilization was her genius.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So the agent who had been kind of browbeated to helping me uh-huh. turns out to have worked at the agency where Penelope was represented. So the other two directors weren't at that agency. So mm. he took the short route and went straight to yeah. Penelope. Luckily, she loved the book and wanted to adapt it. And I mm-hmm. said, well, I'd really like to learn how to write screenplays. So I will give you an option on the book for $1 if mm-hmm. I can write the script with you. And so that's what we did. And this was in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. My dad, for a wedding gift, had mm-hmm. given my then husband and myself computers for our wedding.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this computer weighed 40 pounds. Size of a sewing machine. The
yeah.
screen was this big. And if you wanted to see, you had to scroll back and forth, you know, ooh. After like three letters to see what you were writing.
Yeah.
But you could also, you could put in an external monitor. So the deal that Penelope and I made was that I would come to her house with my computer and she would cook lunch. And I was smart enough at that time to know that I wanted to have my hands on the keyboard.
Yeah.
Because then you can edit as you go along, right?
Right. Kind of shape it how you see it. Yeah.
Yes. Instead of letting that to somebody else. Whenever I've had a writing partner, I've always been on the keyboard. Just call that early self-preservation instinct.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's how Penelope and I got connected. And we had, actually set the movie up, I think, more than once because the options had lapsed, but it never got made. But it was my introduction to the movie business, and her agent, not the same agent that had set me up with her, but at the same agency, loved the script so much he asked if he could represent me, and he is still my agent today.
That's awesome. Oh, you got to love the long-term relationship like that. That's incredible.
I think he's my longest-term relationship of my life.
There's something to be said for that, for sure. For sure. I am a little bit bummed that it hasn't been made into a movie. I haven't had a chance to read it, but I read the premise of it, and that's a pretty pretty intense sounding book. So Firstborn, and it's about an abortion that comes back to life.
Well, it comes back to its mom. It never died. It survived, and it finds its mother. Long before there was all this hullabaloo about abortion. If I had known what was coming, I might have not. The metaphor came because on my 21st birthday, my mother wrote me a birthday card. Mm-hmm. My sort of Tourette's-y mother wrote a birthday card that said, "Luckily, abortion was not legal in 1956, or you wouldn't be here."
Wow.
The most horrific, the horrific thing, and the most hilarious thing I had ever heard of. So the book was kind of a send up of growing up in suburbia.
Yeah.
And it was really a precursor to Edward Scissorhands. It's the same territory.
Right.
A much angrier story, a much more hurt story, if you can imagine such a thing. But very much the same territory. So.
Okay. Interesting. That's, I got to get my hands on it. I got to check that out, because that's pretty interesting. I can't imagine a sadder story though than Edward Scissorhands. I mean, that's that is pretty intense.
Well, it was angrier, and I think sadder. I do. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was in my 20s when I wrote it, and
working out some things.
Yeah, and lucky enough to be fluent enough in the language to be able to express what I felt.
Yeah. Awesome. And that's kind of how you got, Tim Burton got a hold of the book, and that's how he kind of got on his radar with that.
Well, it was a slightly more circuitous path than that, but basically, yes.
Okay. So how was it working? I mean, you know, Edward Scissorhands is, you know, I mean, there's going to be several of your works that are going to be appearing on lists of like classic movies until the end of time. I mean, you know, I just watched Nightmare on Elm Street.
From your lips to God's ears.
Yeah. I mean, like, legitimately, like, we just watched Nightmare Before Christmas. We do it every year, like, right around this time. So, I mean, how does it feel, like, you know, having, you know, being a part of those legacies? They're such massive legacies. And, you know, Edward Scissorhands is such a recognizable character.
It's a total pinch me, I'm dreaming experience. I mean, what would a screenwriter who we largely go unrecognized,
right?
More than largely. I mean, if you ask anybody, most people think Tim Burton wrote both of his movies,
and right?
He didn't write either of them,
right?
But it was fun working with Tim. Mm-hmm. We were really good friends when we started Edward, and people have this fantasy that he stood behind me telling me what to write, but that's not true.
Okay.
I wrote it from my mind. He gave me the absolutely irreplaceable image of the character with scissors for hands. And in many ways, the script was a love letter to him, not literal love, but, you know, emotional love, about not being able to fit in. And Tim, particularly at that time, was such a lost soul that he was easy to write about.
And this was, I mean, before he was a household name, this was when he was still coming up. And yeah.
I mean, Batman made him a household name, but this.
I'm sorry. I totally forgot about Batman.
But I wrote it before Batman came out. I wrote it before he started to direct Batman. Actually.
Okay.
So it was, anyway, so yeah, working with him was lovely. And I mean, Edward Scissorhands will always remain my favorite experience in the business, because it was the rare occasion, my first movie, so had no idea how rare it is, but the rare occasion where everybody was making the same film. So this sort of very delicate, whimsical, sort of odd tone, everybody nailed it.
Everybody was like on the same page and everybody was just vibing the exact same way.
And you have no idea how rare that is. It is
I imagine.
Almost impossible.
I imagine.
Yeah. Well, you have a good imagination.
Well, I mean, I've worked in like, you know, small groups of five people, and that, you know, that in itself could be, so a movie production, you know, you hear horror stories all the time. So, I mean, that's got to be like extremely special to you, that, you know, especially for your first movie, that you got to experience that level of like synchronicity with the whole production. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was ridiculously special. And I did appreciate it, but I didn't realize how special it was.
Well, I mean, that's part of like, you know, kind of just growing. I mean, you know, you kind of, you don't realize like how good you have something until you're, you know, on to the next thing or, you know, something like that. I totally get that.
Until somebody's bludgeoning you and telling you you're not funny and you can't write or, you know, whatever.
Oh man. So, I mean, it wasn't even just, you know, Edward Scissorhands. I mean, you were involved with, I mean, so many movies in the 90s, like, you know, there's, blanking on the Adam's Family. I mean, what was that like getting to work on that? Cause I mean, I feel like that was kind of like one of the first times that like they took a property like that from, you know, a show and made it into a movie.
I guess, you know, Charles Adams was a very famous cartoonist who published in The New Yorker. And when I was a kid, one of my great joys was looking at his cartoons in The New Yorker. And I loved the TV show, but mostly I thought of it as an homage to Charles Adams. It didn't really get to stay that way. It got much broader than dry. Sure. But so that was an interesting one because I was sort of seduced into doing a big movie like that, which, you know, is not really me. And I don't think I ever got seduced again into a big movie because it's not really where I live. But
right.
I met Scott Rudin, the producer, introduced Larry Wilson and myself. Larry was one of the Beetlejuice writers, completely coincidentally.
Yeah.
And we got along so well, we said, sure, that'd be fun. Let's do it. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know how many, you know, we spent at least 18 months just laughing
in my
office. And I think we finally wrote something. And
just throwing ideas back and forth.
Yeah. And eventually it found its way to the screen. But mostly we just, you know, laughed it up.
Love it. I love it. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. You may have kind of started to answer this next question a little bit, but you know, like you even mentioned with your oil painting, I mean, you know, there's like, you know, kind of a macabre vibe to it, but like, you know, it's like this, I've noticed a mix of like macabre and also family friendly. So like, how do you find the middle ground with that?
Well, first of all, kids are the smartest people on earth. You can't pull anything off on them. So
absolutely.
If you're being manipulative or insincere, or you think you can outsmart them, forget about it.
Right.
And they love, you know, sort of dark, spooky things. Interestingly, Nightmare Before Christmas was originally a Disney film. And then when we finished it, the executives at Disney got frightened because they thought, little kids, this is too much for little kids. It's got to be for teenagers and adults. So we'll put it under our other imprimatur, which is Touchstone.
Yeah.
So it did not come out under the Disney label. It came out under the Touchstone label. But I knew kids were going to love it simply because Danny Elfman's daughter, Molly, who was 5 years old at the time, could not stop singing those songs.
Yeah.
Did not stop. And I knew little kids would love it. And little kids do love it, and they still love it. I mean, it's crazy how alive it's still. I don't have kids of my own, but I married a man who has kids, and so through him I have grandkids, and my seven-year-old granddaughter is Sally every year, not because of anything I push on her, but she's obsessed with Sally, and her little sister, it goes as Zero the dog.
That's awesome. That's adorable.
And they're just these. I should put the Sally picture up here so it's behind me. Her mom made the most incredible costume, and the kid is so, you know, it's great. She even made her a trick or treat bag, patchwork like Sally's dress. I mean,
that's awesome.
Yeah, it's very cool.
I have to agree with you. I don't think people give kids enough credit. I think, like, because when this came out, I mean, I remember when this came out, it was massive. And
how old were you?
Ooh, let's see. What year did it come out? What was the year? Was it
1992 or three? I can't remember which.
I was.
Were you even born yet?
7 or 8 years old when that came out. Okay. And I remember being like, this is awesome. Yeah. Like, what is this? Like, and it was just like, you know, and I've always like kind of loved the, you know, like you said, the spooky, the kind of creepy. I've always been drawn to the horror genre even since I was a little kid. So this was just like, it's like, this is a cartoon of a horror movie kind of. And it's like, but it's also Christmas, which I also love Christmas. So I just remember losing my mind.
Yeah. You weren't alone. You got to lose your mind with the whole group of people.
And now, like, new generations are doing it all over, and I love it.
I know. That's pretty wild. I remember I was at a film festival in Spain, in this Sitges film festival in Spain with a film. And one of the European reporters said, well, how does it feel to have written the most beloved cult movie on the planet? I was like, what? What movie? I didn't know which movie he was talking about, to be honest.
Right.
That's a high class problem to have. I didn't know if he was talking about Edward or Nightmare, but it turns out he was talking about Nightmare. And every square I've ever been to of cities in Japan, in Spain, there, in England, there'll be like a Jack Skellington on stilts. There he is.
He's part of the zeitgeist at this point.
He's part of the culture, that's for sure. It's very cool.
My sister, her class had, when she was in high school, one of their guitar classes had like a Christmas concert thing, and they played This Is Halloween at the Christmas concert. So, you know, it's like that. It's even gotten to that point. Like, high school kids are playing it.
That's so
paying
cool.
tribute to it.
That's so cool. I love that. Yeah.
Oh man. So. I do want to ask you about your directorial debut. So with Black Beauty, that was the first time getting behind the director's chair. So were you intimidated by that? Or, I mean, because up till then you just done writing.
That's true. I should have been more intimidated than I was.
I love that. I love that.
And, you know, people think that that it sort of like doesn't fit my body of work that I would do something like that. But the fact of the matter is that, in my mind, all my movies are animal stories. Mm-hmm. I base every character on an animal I've known, either, you know, in my heart or literally. So Edward Scissorhands was based on my best dog. You know, that dog was so alert that it was as if she could, if she'd had larynx and pharynx and blah, blah, you know, you knew she would have been able to speak. But you know, that she was always interested in, and I'm a horse lover, and I to this day. And so Black Beauty, when Warner Brothers after Secret Garden asked me to write Black Beauty, I said, well, I will only write it if I can direct it.
Throwing that out there and seeing if it sticks. Yeah.
And it was, they were a little hesitant, but it stuck. And so that was a very, overwhelming experience, but I survived it, is I guess what I mean. And I'm proud of the film. I had a, you know, we weren't all making the same movie every day, which was very frustrating,
especially after having such a profound experience on the first go round.
And I tried really hard to communicate, but I think we got there tonally. You know, my sensibility is a lot more whimsical than most people's, and so, but I think we got there eventually. But there were people on set who thought, you know, they were going to push me around. There were people, you know, I had like my producer hired, you know, like the cadre of the oldest men in the world. I had a thousand years of of filmmaking experience around me, but most of them couldn't remember my name.
Right.
Because they were so old. But but they were lovely and supportive. And eventually, you know, we all had a love fest. It took a while to get there, but it was really fascinating. I love England. And so it was really great mm-hmm. to live there for 6 months. And you know, it was, yeah, I'm glad I didn't know. I should have been better prepared because I just...
Well, how do you know? I mean, how do you know when it's the first time doing it?
Right. Well, I'd never even shot a short, you know, that's the thing. But, you know, I'd never been written really a movie before I wrote Edward Scissorhands. So mm-hmm. other than Firstborn, you know, it was sort of like, okay, well, I've watched a lot of movies.
Yeah. Did that, killed it. Did that, killed it.
Like, yeah, let's see not? How this works. So, but I didn't think I was a great director, and I didn't really enjoy it, to be honest. I'm very, very isolated person. I really like spending time on my own. So
yeah, it's hard to do when you're the main center of attention with that.
Yeah. When like over 100 people are looking at you and going like, what's next, Gov? You're like, God damn if I know.
Yeah, right.
Well, let's see. You know, there's that hill. Let's go. But I didn't want to feel defeated by it. So I directed a couple more times just to feel like I just didn't have wet feet.
Right.
But like I knew a little bit of what I was doing. So
yeah. And you still found that it's not really your ultimate cup of tea then.
It's not really for me. I have very low blood pressure, so I don't have the stamina of a lot of people. And I can do a 15-hour workday, but I can't do 5 15-hour workdays in a row and be a very happy person.
Yeah, so. I totally get that. That takes a toll on you for sure.
You know, it's such a, I really hope that with all of us women, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. people say, what is it like to have been a pioneer? Well, if I thought about it, I would have been terrified. I just was me. But now that there's so many of us doing these jobs, mm-hmm. I'm hoping that our vision of the world, that's not quite so, I mean, I feel like the movie making is basically based on war making.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, come on, let's tough this out. And, you know, we're football or whatever.
Soldiers, get in line and get it done. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and I'm all for get her done, but, you know, a little kinder, gentler, get her done. So yeah. A 10-hour workday suits me just fine. And
much more reasonable.
And I feel like, you know, the work doesn't suffer for that it actually Agreed. Probably benefits from that. But it's not as macho, you know, it's not as macho a vision. I mean, a few of the men directors I've worked with, I realize that basically they just don't like to go home. They just like to be out on the battlefield like all the time, you know, going, come on, troops, and work harder. And, you know, so that sort of macho activity wasn't really me. And the idea of all these people, as I said, going like, you know, what's next?
Yeah.
I was like, you know, I would be better prepared today, but, you know, it's way gone now.
Yeah.
Thankfully.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think like, you know, kind of what you're saying about how things are changing, I think there is kind of like some kind of social revolution happening where I think we are heading in the right direction. I feel like we're starting to get there. I hope so too.
Yeah, from your lips. Again, you're doing the lips to God's ears thing a lot today. From your lips to God's ears. I, because there's no reason for it to be such a physically punishing activity. I just don't really understand why you can't get a good night's sleep and direct a film.
Well, I mean, you know, I would even say science I says that on my having tombstone. A good night's sleep helps with things. So, I mean, exactly. Like, what is it? Like, there's a study somebody did where it was like after, like in the normal work day, like 9 to 5, like around 3, people are pretty much useless. Like, so, I mean, I can't even imagine, you know, the 15-hour work day, like people have got to be exhausted. I mean, I've done 12-hour days and it's like, ooh, too much.
Well, I think what's interesting now is I think also technologically you would mm-hmm. in those days you would spend so much time waiting to get a scene lit.
Yeah,
there was so much downtime mm-hmm. while that happened, and I my guess is that that wait around time is so much less now because of the speed of the cameras and the, you know, that everything is so that there's no reason why you have to be there, you know, hour unto hour unto hour, other than some kind of, you know, mass sadism or greed on the part of the bosses.
Which I'm sure happens probably more than we want to think.
You know it does.
No, I've heard, I mean, one of my favorite directors, James Cameron, I've heard that, I mean, I love his work, but I would not want to work for that guy because it's just like some of the stuff I've heard, that dude is intense. And that's just like, I don't know, man.
Yes. And he's a very nice guy. I know him, but I wouldn't want to work for him either.
Yeah. Yeah, you could be a nice guy and, you know, and not the perfect boss, but
yeah. Spielberg is the same. He beats the troops from what I understand.
Well, I mean, you know, I guess there's kind of, it's almost like there, you know, there is something to that with the right personality. I mean, Spielberg and, you know, Cameron are, you know, wonderful filmmakers.
Absolutely.
But, you know, not everybody's a Spielberg, not everybody's a Cameron. Some people could probably tone it down.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. So I got a kind of funny, kind of, I think you'll appreciate this because it's got kind of a macabre nature to it. So when you directed Black Beauty, you directed Sean Bean. Now, Sean Bean is notorious for dying in his movies, with Black Beauty being a, you know, among a handful of exceptions. So what was it like? What's it like to be one of the directors that hasn't killed Sean Bean?
That's pretty funny.
I try to throw little goofy ones in there every now and then.
He was actually difficult to work with for me because he was playing the part of a farmer, mm-hmm. and he, for example, had to drive a cart. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if we used the footage. I can't recall. But anyway, he was just sitting there slouching in the cart. Mm-hmm. Right. And I said, Sean, you know, sit up, be proud. And he said, I'm a farmer. And I said, well, you've got your own rig, you've got your horse, you've got your own land. I mean, this is a great source of pride in the Victorian era, you know, sit up and show us. So we had a disagreement about that. He was only with me for a few days, so I didn't get to know him terribly well, but no, I didn't kill him. I could have killed him.
Yeah. Have him fall off the horse.
Sit up. I felt like killing him.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, because so he was kind of looking at it from like looking at from an upper class perspective.
Yes.
Wow, that's
interesting. I know. I thought that was a bit shocking, especially since he himself is not sort of a posh.
Right.
I don't think he has a. He couldn't have a posh background with that accent. He does. You know, it's just he doesn't.
Right.
So maybe he was just mirroring the sort of sad sacks he grew up with.
Yeah,
I don't know.
That's true. I mean, that's interesting, though. I wonder. Yeah, it makes you wonder how he got into that headspace.
And he didn't want to take riding lessons. He learned to ride later, obviously, mm-hmm. on Game of Thrones. He was very good on a horse, but so I often just took him off and had him standing next to the horse, like where the horse is drinking from the pond. I just stand there, Sean. I know we're over here. Just stand there. He seemed not to have much interest in what he was doing. And I hope he doesn't hear this. I don't want to hurt his feelings. I hope this doesn't make its way to him, because that would be me. And that would be no intention of mine to hurt his feelings. He's a lovely guy, but
who knows what was going on at the time either. He may have had something in his head that he just wasn't able to get the right focus in or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Benefit of the doubt.
And he wasn't as big a star then as he is now. So
right.
I think he had sort of aspirations. And so, and a lot of the actors on the movie, by the way, I would say, could you take a couple steps to your right, because you're blocking our eye line to the horse.
It is about a horse.
It's called Black Beauty. And this one actor, you know, you're wearing a headset, right? As the director, and they're mic'd remotely. And I don't think he realized that his mic was still activated, this one actor. And he said with great offense to an actor beside him, he said, did you just hear that she asked me to get out of the way of the horse? So, a few of them had troubles in this arena. I mean, maybe in general. And also, here's the other thing. I was an American directing a beloved British classic.
Right.
And this is pre-Harry Potter, when we were being asked by the studio to sort of Americanize dialogue a little bit.
Sure.
Make it easier for an American audience to understand the words.
Right.
And make ask people to speak more slowly. That shifted with Harry Potter, luckily. But, and I was pretty resistant to it. But, you know, I would say, you know, could you speak a little slower? Mm-hmm. Or, yeah, that inflection is very American. I understand, but that's how I want you to say it.
Right.
Or whatever. So you know, it there wasn't quite the love of the American audiences that I think blossomed later.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. I mean, that's, you know, kind of culture shock, and everybody's, you know, some people are feeling a certain kind of way about it. And
well, and I, we had a royal premiere of Black Beauty, and mm-hmm. I did overhear Princess Anne saying something about Yank directing a beloved British, you know, iconographic story. So
it's like, dude, we're allies now. Come on, let's put that aside.
And here's the funny thing is that genetically I'm more British than most of the people that were on my crew. I'm it turns out, sadly, 100% from the British Isles.
Yeah.
Genetically.
Well, there you go.
And my first AD, for example, his last name was Carreras. Now, that is not a British name.
Right.
That's an Italian name. So ironically, I was more British than many of the people who claim to be more British than I.
So really, you were the perfect person to direct this movie then.
That's it. I tried to explain it to them, but, you know, who listens?
Hey, they won't listen, nope. Right?
Nobody listens to the director, really.
Oh, I love it. I love it. So do you have anything else on your list that you're wanting to accomplish in the entertainment industry? I mean, anything, any other mountains you're wanting to climb?
Well, you know, I do occasionally entertain the idea of writing a script here and there. Mm-hmm. I am in talks to do one right now. They all turn out to be animation projects, which is interesting.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, you know, I love writing. I love what mm-hmm. I do. I do love being micromanaged.
Right.
And I do love to be paid. So micromanagement is much more prevalent and the salaries are much lower than they used to be. So it takes a very rare thing to draw my attention. And that's as it should be. I'm 65 yeah. years old now. I'm an old lady. I have a lot to do before I go, and, you know, being somebody's, you know, whipping post is not anything I need to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's the thing, is like, do what makes you happy. And that's awesome that you're able to do that. I love it.
Well, and you know, I was really blessed that by and large in the business, I can't think of a single instance where I had to take a job for the money. I never did. I got to pick and choose. And, you know, I say I love the money. Well, what I really love is a good project, is a beautiful project, yeah.
The money is just a very nice extra.
It is. But I mean, I've been called the B word quite a bit in my career, but it's only because I care. You know, I think of these projects as my babies, and I put my heart and soul in them, and I really, really care about them. And so I am going to fight for them. And if I get called names because of it, oh, well.
Oh, well. Yeah, no, I cannot resonate with that enough. Like, that's how I feel about, you know, my creative projects. I totally, you know, from one creative person to another, I just totally, totally get where you're coming from with that. And that's awesome that you've been able to, you know, kind of make a career out of that. And I love it. I love it so much.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Well, is there any anything that any projects you want to plug, or any social medias or anything you're wanting to?
No, well, I'm very not social media, so I don't have much of anything to push. No, just me.
No problem at all. No problem at all. I appreciate you so much for being here. This has been a blast.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate your asking.